Hello and welcome. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time. This week we bring you another story by Anton Chekhov, The Artist's Story. I like this one because it shows Chekhov's political side with a dash of romance mixed in. One reviewer said of Chekhov, "You realize what a master storyteller Chekhov really is. He constructs a story so elegantly, the characters displayed like fine silver on a table setting." I hope you enjoy this evening's story. And now, The Artist's Story by Anton Chekhov. It was 6 or 7 years ago when I was living in one of the districts of the province of Tuva, on the estate of a young landowner called Bayalokorov, who used to get up very early, wear a peasant tunic, drink beer in the evenings, and continually complain to me that he never met with sympathy from anyone. He lived in the lodge in the garden, and I in the old seigneurial house, in a big room with columns, where there was no furniture except a wide sofa, on which I used to sleep, and a table on which I used to lay out patients. There was always, even in still weather, a droning noise in the old Amos stove, and in thunderstorms the whole house shook and seemed to be cracking into pieces. And it was rather terrifying, especially at night, when all the 10 big windows were suddenly lit up by lightning. Condemned by destiny to perpetual idleness, I did absolutely nothing. For hours together I'd gaze out of window at the sky, at the birds, at the avenue, read everything that was brought me by post, slept. Sometimes I went out of the house and wandered about till late in the evening. One day, as I was returning home, I accidentally strayed into a place I did not know. The sun was already sinking and the shades of evening lay across the flowering rye. Two rows of old, closely planted, very tall fir trees stood like two dense walls, forming a picturesque, gloomy avenue. I easily climbed over the fence and walked along the avenue, slipping over the fir needles which lay 2 inches deep on the ground. It was still and dark, and only here and there, on the high treetops, the vivid golden light quivered and made rainbows in the spiders' webs. There was a strong, almost stifling smell of resin. Then I turned into a long avenue of limes. Here, too, all was desolation and age. Last year's leaves rusted mournfully under my feet, and in the twilight, shadows lurked between the trees. From the old orchard on the right came the faint, reluctant note of the golden oriole, who must have been old too. But at last the limes ended. I walked by an old white house of 2 stories with a terrace, and there, suddenly opened before me, a view of a courtyard, a large pond with a bathing house, a group of green willows, and a village on the further bank, with a high, narrow belfry, on which there glittered a cross reflecting the setting sun. For a moment it breathed upon me the fascination of something near and very familiar, as though I had seen that landscape at some time in my childhood. At the white stone gates which led from the yard to the fields, an old-fashioned solid gate with lions on them, were standing 2 girls. One of them, the elder, a pale, slim, very handsome girl with a perfect haystack of chestnut hair and a little obstinate mouth, had a severe expression and scarcely took notice of me, while the other, who was still very young, not more than 17 or 18, and was also slim and pale with a large mouth and large eyes, looked at me with astonishment as I passed, said something in English, and was overcome with embarrassment. And it seemed to me that these 2 charming faces, too, had long been familiar to me, and I returned home feeling as though I had had a delightful dream. One morning, soon afterwards, as Bielokorov and I were walking near the house, a carriage drove unexpectedly into the yard, rustling over the grass, and in it was sitting one of those girls. It was the elder one. She had come to ask for subscriptions for some villagers whose cottages had been burnt down. Speaking with great earnestness and precision, and not looking at us, she told us how many houses in the village of Sienovo had been burnt, how many women and men and children were left homeless, and what steps were proposed to begin with by the Relief Committee, of which she was now a member. After handing us the subscription list for our signatures, she put it away and immediately began to take leave of us. "You have quite forgotten us, Pyotr Petrovich," she said to Bielokurov as she shook hands with him. "Do come, and if Monsieur N," she mentioned my name, "cares to make the acquaintance of admirers of his work, and will come and see us, Mother and I will be delighted." I bowed. When she had gone, Pyotr Petrovich began to tell me about her. The girl was, he said, of good family, and her name was Lydia Volchaninov, and the estate on which she lived with her mother and sister, like the village on the other side of the pond, was called Shilkovka. Her father had once held an important position in Moscow, and had died with the rank of Privy Councillor. Although they had ample means, the Volchaninovs lived on their estate, summer and winter, without going away. Lydia was a teacher in the Zemstvo school in her own village, and received a salary of 25 rubles a month. She spent nothing on herself but her salary, and was proud of earning her own living.
"An interesting family," said Bielokurov. "Let us go over one day. They will be delighted to see you."
One afternoon, on a holiday, we thought of the Volchaninovs and went to Shelkovka to see them. They, the mother and two daughters, were at home. The mother, Ekaterina Pavlovna, who at one time had been handsome, but now, asthmatic, depressed, vague, and over feeble for her years, tried to entertain me with conversation about painting. Having heard from her daughter that I might come to Shilkovna, she had hurriedly recalled two or three of my landscapes, which she had seen in exhibitions in Moscow, and now asked what I meant to express by them. Lydia, or as they called her, Lida, talked more to Bielokurov than to me. Earnest and unsmiling, she asked him why he was not on the Zemstvo, and why he had not attended any of its meetings. "It's not right, Pyotr Petrovich," she said reproachfully. "It's not right. It's too bad."
"Oh, that's true, Lida, that's true," the mother assented. "It isn't right."
"Our whole district is in the hands of the Balagan," Lida went on, addressing me. "He is the chairman of the Zemstvo board, and he has distributed all the posts in the district among his nephews and sons-in-law, and he does as he likes. He ought to be opposed. The young men ought to make a strong party. But you see what the young men among us are like. It's a shame, Pyotr Petrovich." The younger sister, Zhenya, was silent while they were talking of the Zemstvo. She took no part in serious conversation. She was not looked upon as quite grown up by her family, and, like a child, was always called by the nickname of Missus, because that was what she had called her English governess when she was a child. She was all the time looking at me with curiosity, and when I glanced at the photographs in the album, she explained to me, "That's uncle, that's godfather," moving her finger across the photograph. As she did so, she touched me with her shoulder like a child, and I had a close view of her delicate, undeveloped chest, her slender shoulders, her plate, and her thin little body, tightly drawn in by her sash. We played croquet and lawn tennis, we walked about the garden, drank tea, and then sat a long time over supper. After the huge, empty room with columns, I felt, as it were, at home in this small, snug house, where there were no oleographs on the walls and where the servants were spoken to with civility. And everything seemed to me young and pure, thanks to the presence of Lida and Missus, and there was an atmosphere of refinement over everything. At supper, Lida talked to Bielokurov again, of the Zemstvo, of Balagan, and of school libraries. She was an energetic, genuine girl with convictions, and it was interesting to listen to her, though she talked a great deal and in a loud voice, perhaps because she was accustomed to talking at school. On the other hand, Pyotr Petrovich, who had retained from his student days the habit of turning every conversation into an argument, was tedious, flat, long-winded, and unmistakably anxious to appear clever and advanced. Gesticulating,
He upset a sauceboat with his sleeve, making a huge pool on the tablecloth, but no one except me appeared to notice it. It was dark and still as we went home.
Good breeding is shown not by upsetting the sauce, but by not noticing it when somebody else does, said Bielokurov with a sigh. Yes, a splendid intellectual family. I've dropped out of all decent society. It's dreadful how I've dropped out. It's all through work, work, work.
He talked of how hard one had to work if one wanted to be a model farmer, and I thought what a heavy, sluggish fellow he was. Whenever he talked of anything serious, he articulated, "Rrr," with intense effort, and worked just as he talked, slowly, always late, and behindhand. I had little faith in his business capacity, if only from the fact that when I gave him letters to post, he carried them about in his pocket for weeks together.
"The hardest thing of all," he muttered as he walked beside me, "the hardest thing of all is that, work as one may, one meets with no sympathy from anyone. No sympathy!"
I took to going to see the Volchaninovs. As a rule, I sat on the lower step of the terrace. I was fretted by dissatisfaction with myself. I was sorry at the thought of my life passing so rapidly and uninterestingly, and felt as though I would like to tear out of my breast the heart which had grown so heavy. And meanwhile, I heard talk on the terrace, the rustling of dresses, the pages of a book being turned. I soon grew accustomed to the idea that during the day Lydia received patients, gave out books, and often went into the village with a parasol and no hat, and in the evening talked aloud of Zemstvo and schools. This slim, handsome, invariably austere girl, with her small, well-cut mouth, always said dryly when the conversation turned upon serious subjects, "That's of no interest to you." She did not like me. She disliked me because I was a landscape painter, and did not in my pictures portray the privations of the peasants, and that, as she fancied, was indifferent to what she put such faith in. I remember when I was traveling on the banks of Lake Baikal, I met a Buryat girl on horseback, wearing a shirt and trousers of blue Chinese canvas. I asked her if she would sell me her pipe. While we talked, she looked contemptuously at my European face and hat, and in a moment she was bored with talking to me. She shouted to her horse and galloped on. And in just that same way, Lida despised me as an alien. She never outwardly expressed her dislike for me, but I felt it. And sitting on the lower steps of the terrace, I felt irritated, and said that doctoring peasants while one was not a doctor was deceiving them, and that it was easy to be benevolent when one had 6,000 acres. Meanwhile, her sister Missus had no cares, and spent her life in complete idleness, just as I did. When she got up in the morning, she immediately took up a book and sat down to read on the terrace in a deep armchair, with her feet hardly touching the ground, or hid herself with her book in the lime avenue, or walked out into the fields. She spent the whole day reading, poring greedily over her book, and only from the tired, dazed look in her eyes and the extreme paleness of her face, one could divine how this continual reading exhausted her brain. When I arrived, she would flush a little, leave her book, and looking into my face with her big eyes, would tell me eagerly of anything that had happened. For instance, that the chimney had been on fire in the servants' hall, or that one of the men had caught a huge fish in the pond. On ordinary days, she usually went about in a light blouse and a dark blue skirt. We went for walks together, picked cherries for making jam, went out in the boat. When she jumped up to reach a cherry or scull in the boat, her thin, weak arms showed through her transparent sleeves. Or I painted a sketch, and she stood beside me, watching rapturously. One Sunday, at the end of July, I came to the Volchaninovs about 9 o'clock in the morning. I walked about the park, keeping a good distance from the house, looking for white mushrooms, of which there was a great number that summer, and noting their position so as to come and pick them afterwards with Jenya. There was a warm breeze. I saw Jenya and her mother, both in light holiday dresses, coming home from church. Jenya holding her hat in the wind. Afterwards, I heard them having tea on the terrace. For a careless person like me, trying to find justification for my perpetual idleness, these holiday mornings in our country houses in the summer have always had a particular charm. When the green garden, still wet with dew, is all sparkling in the sun and looks radiant with happiness, when there is a scent of mignonette and oleander near the house, when the young people have just come back from church and are having breakfast in the garden, all so charmingly dressed and gay, and one knows that all these healthy, well-fed, handsome people are going to do nothing the whole day long, one wishes that all life were like that. Now, too, I had the same thought, and walked about the garden, prepared to walk about like that, aimless and unoccupied the whole day, the whole summer. Jenya came out with a basket. She had a look in her face, as though she knew she would find me in the garden, or had a presentiment of it. We gathered mushrooms and talked, and when she asked a question, she walked a little ahead so as to see my face. "A miracle happened in the village yesterday," she said. "The lame woman, Pelagia, has been ill the whole year. No doctors or medicine did her any good, but yesterday an old woman came and whispered something over her, and her illness passed away."
"That's nothing much," I said. "You mustn't look for miracles only among the sick people and old women. Isn't health a miracle? And life itself? Whatever is beyond understanding is a miracle."
"Aren't you afraid of what is beyond understanding?"
"No. Phenomena I don't understand, I face boldly, and am not overwhelmed by them. I am above them. Man ought to recognize himself as superior to lions and tigers, stars, superior to everything in nature, even what seems miraculous and is beyond his understanding, or else he is not a man but a mouse, afraid of everything."
Jenya believed that as an artist I knew a very great deal, and could guess correctly what I did not know. She longed for me to initiate her into the domain of the eternal and the beautiful, into that high world in which, as she imagined, I was quite at home. And she talked to me of God, of the eternal life, of the miraculous. And I, who could never admit that myself and my imagination would be lost forever after death, answered,
"Yes, men are immortal. Yes, there is eternal life in store for us."
And she listened, believed, and did not ask for proofs. As we were going home, she stopped suddenly and said, "Our Lida is a remarkable person, isn't she? I love her very dearly and would be ready to give my life for her any minute. But tell me," Jenya touched my sleeve with her finger, "tell me, why do you always argue with her? Why are you irritated?"
"Because she's wrong."
Jenya shook her head and tears came into her eyes. "How incomprehensible that is," she said.
At that minute, Lida had just returned from somewhere and was standing with a whip in her hand, a slim, beautiful figure in the sunlight, at the steps. She was giving some orders to one of the men. Talking loudly, she hurriedly received two or three sick villagers. Then, with a busy and anxious face, she walked about the rooms, opening one cupboard after another, and went upstairs. It was a long time before they could find her and call her to dinner, and she came in when we had finished our soup. All these tiny details I remember with tenderness, and that whole day I remember vividly, though nothing special happened. After dinner, Jenya lay in a long armchair reading, while I sat upon the bottom step of the terrace. We were silent. The whole sky was overcast with clouds, and it began to spot with fine rain. It was hot. The wind had dropped, and it seemed as though the day would never end. Ekaterina Pavlovna came out on the terrace looking drowsy and carrying a fan.
"Oh, mother," said Jenya, kissing her hand, "it's not good for you to sleep in the day."
They adored each other. When one went into the garden, the other would stand on the terrace and, looking towards the trees, call, "Au, Jenya," or,
Mother, where are you?
They always said their prayers together and had the same faith, and they understood each other perfectly, even when they did not speak, and their attitude to people was the same. Ekaterina Pavlovna, too, grew quickly used to me and fond of me, and when I did not come for 2 or 3 days, sent to ask if I were well. She, too, gazed at my sketches with enthusiasm, and with the same openness and readiness to chatter as masseuse, she told me what had happened and confided to me her domestic secrets. She had a perfect reverence for her elder daughter. Lida did not care for endearments. She talked only of serious matters. She lived her life apart, and to her mother and sister was as sacred and enigmatic a person as the admiral always sitting in his cabin is to the sailors.
"Our Lida is a remarkable person," the mother would say often. "Isn't she?"
Now, too, while it was drizzling with rain, we talked of Lida.
"She is a remarkable girl," said her mother, and added in an undertone, like a conspirator looking about her timidly, "You wouldn't easily find another like her. Only do you know, I'm beginning to be a little uneasy. The school, the dispensary, books, all that's very good, but why go to extremes? She is 23, you know. It's time for her to think seriously of herself. With her books and her dispensary, she will find life has slipped by without having noticed it. She must be married."
Jenya, pale from reading, with her hair disarranged, raised her head and said, as it were to herself, looking at her mother,
"Mother, everything is in God's hands."
And again she buried herself in her book. Bielokhorov came in his tunic and embroidered shirt. He played croquet and tennis. Then, when it got dark, sat a long time over supper and talked again about schools and about Balagin, who had the whole district under his thumb. As I went away from the Volchaninovs that evening, I carried away the impression of a long, long, idle day, with a melancholy consciousness that everything ends in this world, however long it may be. Jenya saw us out to the gate, and perhaps because she had been with me all day, from morning till night, I felt dull without her, and that all that charming family were near and dear to me, and for the first time that summer I had a yearning to paint.
"Tell me, why do you lead such a dreary, colorless life?" I asked Bielokhorov as we went home.
"My life is dreary, difficult, and monotonous because I am an artist, a strange person. From my earliest days I've been wrung by envy, self-dissatisfaction, distrust in my work. I'm always poor. I'm a wanderer."
"But you're a healthy, normal man, a landowner and a gentleman. Why do you live in such an uninteresting way? Why do you get so little out of life? Why haven't you, for instance, fallen in love with Lydia or Jenya?"
"Well, you forget that I love another woman," answered Bielokhorov.
He was referring to Lyubov Ivanovna, the lady who shared the lodge with him. Every day I saw this lady, very plump, rotund, and dignified, not unlike a fat goose walking about the garden in the Russian national dress and beads, always carrying a parasol, and the servant was continually calling her in to dinner or to tea. 3 years before, she had taken one of the lodges for a summer holiday and had settled down at Bielokhorov's, apparently forever. She was 10 years older than he was, and kept a sharp hand over him, so much so that he had to ask her permission when he went out of the house. She often sobbed in a deep, masculine note, and then I used to send word that if she did not leave off, I should give up my rooms here. And she left off. When we got home, Bielokhorov sat down on the sofa and frowned thoughtfully, and I began walking up and down the room, conscious of a soft emotion, as though I were in love. I wanted to talk about the Volchaninovs.
Lida could only fall in love with a member of the Zemstvo, as devoted to schools and hospitals as she is, I said. Oh, for the sake of a girl like that, one might not only go into the Zemstvo, but even wear out iron shoes, like the girl in the fairy tale.
And masseuse, what a sweet creature she is, that masseuse.
Bielokhorov, drawing out began a long-winded disquisition on the malady of the age, pessimism.
He talked confidently in a tone that suggested that I was opposing him. Hundreds of miles of desolate, monotonous, burnt-up steppe cannot induce such deep depression as one man when he sits and talks, and one does not know when he will go. "It's not a question of pessimism or optimism," I said irritably. "It's simply that 99 people out of 100 have no sense." Bielokurov took this as aimed at himself, was offended, and went away.
"The prince is staying at Mozyalova, and he asked to be remembered to you," said Lydia to her mother. She had just come in and was taking off her gloves. "He gave me a great deal of interesting news. He promised to raise the question of a medical relief center at Malyumovo again in the Provincial Assembly, but he says there is very little hope of it." And turning to me, she said, "Oh, excuse me, I always forget that this cannot be interesting to you."
I felt irritated. "Why not interesting to me?" I said, shrugging my shoulders. "You do not care to know my opinion, but I assure you the question has great interest for me."
"Yes?"
"Yes. In my opinion, a medical relief center at Malyumovo is quite unnecessary." My irritation infected her. She looked at me, screwing up her eyes, and asked,
"What is necessary? Landscapes?"
"Landscapes are not either. Nothing is." She finished taking off her gloves and opened the newspaper which had just been brought from the post. A minute later she sat quietly, evidently restraining herself.
"Last week Anna died in childbirth, and if there had been a medical relief center near, she would have lived. And I think even landscape painters ought to have some opinions on the subject."
"I have a very definite opinion on that subject, I assure you," I answered, and she screened herself with the newspaper as though unwilling to listen to me. "To my mind, all these schools, dispensaries, libraries, medical relief centers, under present conditions, only serve to aggravate the bondage of the people. The peasants are fettered by a great chain, and you do not break the chain, but only add fresh links to it. That's my view of it." She raised her eyes to me and smiled ironically, and I went on trying to formulate my leading idea. "What matters is not that Anna died in childbirth, but that all these Annas, Mavras, Pelagias, toil from early morning till dark, fall ill from working beyond their strength, all their lives tremble for their sick and hungry children, all their lives are being doctored and in dread of death and disease, fade and grow old early, and die in filth and stench. Their children begin the same story over again as soon as they are grown up, and so it goes on for hundreds of years, and myriads of men live worse than beasts, in continual terror, for a mere crust of bread. The whole horror of their position lies in their never having time to think of their souls, of their image and semblance. Cold, hunger, animal terror, a burden of toil, like avalanches of snow, block them every way to spiritual activity. That is, to what distinguishes man from the brutes, and what is the only thing which makes life worth living. You go to their help with hospitals and schools, but you don't free them from their fetters by that. On the contrary, you bind them in closer bonds, as by introducing new prejudices, you increase the number of their wants, to say nothing of the fact that they've got to pay the Zemstvo for drugs and books, and so toil harder than ever."
"I am not going to argue with you," said Lydia, putting down the paper. "I've heard all that before. I will only say one thing. One cannot sit with one's hands in one's lap. It's true that we are not saving humanity, and perhaps we make a great many mistakes. But we do what we can, and we are right. The highest and holiest task for a civilized being is to serve his neighbors. And we try to serve them as best we can. You don't like it, but one can't please everyone."
"Well, that's true, Lida," said her mother. "That's true."
In Lida's presence, she was always a little timid, and looked at her nervously as she talked, afraid of saying something superfluous or inopportune, and she never contradicted her, but always assented.
"That's true, Lida, that's true."
Teaching the peasants to read and write, books of wretched precepts and rhymes, and medical relief centers cannot diminish either ignorance or the death rate. Just as the light from your windows cannot light up this huge garden, said I. You give nothing. But meddling in these people's lives, you only create new wants in them and new demands on their labor.
Oh, good heavens! But one must do something, said Lydia with vexation.
And from her tone, one could see that she thought my arguments worthless and despised them.
The people must be freed from hard physical labor, said I.
We must lighten their yoke. Let them have time to breathe, that they may not spend all their lives at the stove, at the washtub, and in the fields, but may also have time to think of their souls, of God, may have time to develop their spiritual capacities.
The highest vocation of man is spiritual activity, the perpetual search for truth and the meaning of life. Make coarse animal labor unnecessary for them. Let them feel themselves free. And then you will see what a mockery these dispensaries and books are. Once a man recognizes his true vocation, he can only be satisfied by religion, science, and art, and not by these trifles.
Free them from labor? laughed Lydia. But is that possible?
Yes. Take upon yourself a share of their labor. If all of us, townspeople and country people, all without exception, would agree to divide between us the labor which mankind spends on the satisfaction of their physical needs, each of us would perhaps need to work only for 2 or 3 hours a day. Imagine that we all, rich and poor, work only for 3 hours a day, and the rest of our time is free. Imagine further that in order to depend even less upon our bodies and to labor less, we invent machines to replace our work. We try to cut down on our needs to the minimum. We would harden ourselves and our children that they should not be afraid of hunger and cold, and that we shouldn't be continually trembling for their health like Anna, Mavra, and Pelagia. Imagine that we don't doctor ourselves. Don't keep dispensaries, tobacco factories, distilleries. What a lot of free time would be left us, after all. All of us together would devote our leisure to science and art, just as the peasants sometimes work the whole community together, mending the roads. So all of us, as a community, would search for truth and the meaning of life. And I am convinced that the truth would be discovered very quickly. Man would escape from this continual, agonizing, oppressive dread of death, and even from death itself.
You contradict yourself, though, said Lida. You talk about science and are yourself opposed to elementary education.
Elementary education when a man has nothing to read but signs on public houses and sometimes books which he can't understand. Such education has existed among us since the times of Rorik. Gogol's Petrushka has been read for ever so long. Yet, as the village was in the days of Rorik, so it has remained. What is needed is not elementary education, but freedom from a wide development of spiritual capacities. What are wanted are not schools, but universities.
You are opposed to medicine, too?
Yes. It would be necessary only for the study of diseases as natural phenomenon, and not for the cure of them. If one must cure, it should not be diseases, but the causes of them. Remove the principal cause, physical labor, and then there will be no disease. I don't believe in a science that cures disease, I went on excitedly. When science and art are real, they aim not at temporary private ends, but at eternal and universal. They seek for truth and the meaning of life. They seek for God, for the soul, and when they are tied down to the needs and evils of the day, to dispensaries and libraries, they only complicate and hamper life. We have plenty of doctors, chemists, lawyers, plenty of people can read and write, but we are quite without biologists, mathematicians, philosophers, and poets. The whole of our intelligence, the whole of our spiritual energy, is spent on satisfying temporary, passing needs. Scientific men, writers, artists are hard at work. Thanks to them, the conveniences of life are multiplied from day to day. Our physical demands increase, yet truth is still a long way off, and man still remains the most rapacious and dirty animal. Everything is tending to the degeneration of the majority of mankind and the loss forever of all fitness for life. In such conditions, an artist's work has no meaning.
and the more talented he is, the stranger and the more unintelligible is his position. As one looks into it, it is evident that he is working for the amusement of a rapacious and unclean animal, and is supporting the existing order. And I don't care to work, and I won't work. Nothing is any use. Let the earth sink to perdition!
Missus, go out of the room, said Lita to her sister, apparently thinking my words pernicious to the young girl. Jenya looked mournfully at her mother and sister, and went out of the room.
These are charming things people say when they want to justify their indifference, said Lita. It is easier to disapprove of schools and hospitals than to teach or heal.
That's true, Lita, that's true, the mother assented.
You threatened to give up working, said Lita. You evidently set a high value on your work. Let us give up arguing. We shall not agree, since I put the most imperfect dispensary or library of which you have just spoken so contemptuously on a higher level than any landscape. And turning at once to her mother, she began speaking in quite a different tone.
The prince is very much changed, and much thinner than when he was with us last. He's being sent to Vichy.
She told her mother about the prince in order to avoid talking to me. Her face glowed, and to hide her feelings she bent low over the table as though she were short-sighted, and made a show of reading the newspaper. My presence was disagreeable to her. I said goodbye and went home. It was quite still out of doors. The village on the further side of the pond was already asleep. There was not a light to be seen, and only the stars were faintly reflected in the pond. At the gate with the lions on it, Jenya was standing motionless, waiting to escort me. "Everyone is asleep in the village," I said to her, trying to make out her face in the darkness, and I saw her mournful dark eyes fixed upon me. "The publican house and the horse dealers are asleep, while we well-bred people argue and irritate each other." It was a melancholy August night, melancholy because there was already a feeling of autumn. The moon was rising behind a purple cloud, and it shed a faint light upon the road and on the dark fields of winter corn by the sides. From time to time a star fell. Jenya walked beside me along the road and tried not to look at the sky, that she might not see the falling stars, which for some reason frightened her.
"I believe you are right," she said, shivering with the damp night air. "If people altogether could devote themselves to spiritual needs, they would soon know everything."
"Of course. We are higher beings, and if we were really to recognize the whole force of human genius and lived only for higher ends, we should in the end become like gods. But that will never be. Mankind will degenerate till no trace of genius remains." When the gates were out of sight, Jenya stopped and shook hands with me.
"Good night," she said, shivering.
She had nothing but her blouse over her shoulders and was shrinking with cold.
"Come tomorrow?"
I felt wretched at the thought of being left alone and irritated and dissatisfied with myself and other people. And I, too, tried not to look at the falling stars. "Stay a minute," I said to her. "I entreat you."
I loved Jenya. I must have loved her because she met me when I came home and saw me off when I went away, because she looked at me tenderly and enthusiastically. How touchingly beautiful were her pale face, slender neck, slender arms, her weakness, her idleness, her reading, and intelligence. I suspected in her intelligence above the average. I was fascinated by the breadth of her views, perhaps because they were different from those of the stern, handsome Lita who disliked me. Jenya liked me because I was an artist. I had conquered her heart by my talent, and had a passionate desire to paint, for her sake alone, and I dreamed of her as my little queen, who with me would possess those trees, those fields, the mists, the dawn, the exquisite and beautiful scenery, in the midst of which I had felt myself hopelessly solitary and useless. "Stay another minute," I begged her. "I beseech you." I took off my overcoat and put it over her chilly shoulders. Afraid of looking ugly and absurd in a man's overcoat, she laughed and threw it off. And at that instant, I put my arms round her and covered her face, shoulders, and hands with kisses. "Till tomorrow," she whispered, and softly, as though afraid of breaking upon the silence of the night, she embraced me. We have no secrets from one another. I must tell my mother and my sister at once. It's so dreadful. Mother is all right. Mother likes you. But Lida...
She ran to the gates.
Goodbye, she called.
And then for 2 minutes I heard her running. I did not want to go home, and I had nothing to go for. I stood still for a little time hesitating, and made my way slowly back to look once more at the house in which she lived, the sweet, simple old house, which seemed to be watching me from the windows of its upper story, and understanding all about it. I walked by the terrace, sat on the seat by the tennis ground in the dark under the old elm tree, and looked from there at the house. In the windows of the top story, where Masseuse slept, there appeared a bright light which changed to a soft green. They had covered the lamp with the shade. Shadows began to move. I was full of tenderness and peace and satisfaction within myself. Satisfaction at having been able to be carried away by my feelings and having fallen in love. And at that same time I felt uncomfortable at the thought that only a few steps away from me, in one of the rooms of that house, there was Lida, who disliked me and perhaps hated me. I went on sitting there wondering whether Jenya would come out, and I listened and fancied I'd heard voices talking upstairs. About an hour passed, the green light went out, and the shadows were no longer visible. The moon was standing high above the house, and lighting up the sleeping garden and the paths. The dahlias and the roses in front of the house could be seen distinctly, and looked all the same color. It began to grow very cold. I went out of the garden, picked up my coat on the road, and slowly sauntered home. When next day, after dinner, I went to the Volchaninovs, the glass door to the garden was wide open. I sat down on the terrace, expecting Jenya every minute, to appear from behind the flower bed on the lawn, or from one of the avenues, or that I should hear her voice from the house. Then I walked into the drawing room, the dining room. There was not a soul to be seen. From the dining room I walked along the long corridor to the hall and back. In this corridor there were several doors, and through one of them I heard the voice of Lida.
"God sent a crow," she said in a loud, emphatic voice, probably dictating. "God sent a crow a piece of cheese. A crow a piece of cheese. Who's there?" she called suddenly, hearing my steps.
"It's I."
"Ah, excuse me. I cannot come out to you this minute. I'm giving Dasha her lesson."
"Is Ekaterina Pavlovna in the garden?"
"No. She went away with my sister this morning, to our aunt in the province of Penza, and in the winter they will probably go abroad," she added after a pause.
"God sent the crow a piece of cheese. Have you written it?"
I went into the hall and stared vacantly at the pond and the village, and the sound reached me of "a piece of cheese. God sent the crow a piece of cheese." And I went back, by the way I had come here for the first time, first from the yard into the garden past the house, then into the avenue of lime trees. At this point, I was overtaken by a small boy who gave me a note. "I told my sister everything, and she insists on my parting from you," I read. "I could not wound her by disobeying. God will give you forgiveness. Forgive me. If only you knew how bitterly my mother and I are crying." Then there was the dark fir avenue, the broken-down fence, on the field where then the rye was in flower and the corn cracks were calling. Now there were cows and hobbled horses. On the slope there were bright green patches of winter corn. A sober workaday feeling came over me, and I felt ashamed of all I had said at the Volchaninovs, and felt bored with life as I had been before. When I got home, I packed and set off that evening for Petersburg. I never saw the Volchaninovs again. Not long ago, on my way to Crimea, I met Bielokurov in the train. As before, he was wearing a jerkin and an embroidered shirt, and when I asked how he was, he replied that, God be praised, he was well. We began talking. He had sold his estate and bought another smaller one in the name of Lyubov Ivanovna. He could tell me little about the Volchaninovs. Lida, he said, was still living in Shelkovka and teaching in the school. She had, by degrees, succeeded in gathering round her a circle of people sympathetic to her, who made a strong party, and at the last election had turned out Balagin, who had, till then, had the whole district under his thumb. About Zhenya, he only told me that she did not live at home, and that he did not know where she was. I am beginning to forget the old house, and only sometimes when I am painting or reading, I suddenly, apropos of nothing, remember the green light in the window, the sound of my footsteps as I walked home through the fields in the night, with my heart full of love, rubbing my hands in the cold. And still, more rarely, at moments when I am sad and depressed by loneliness, I have dim memories, and little by little, I begin to feel that she is thinking of me too, that she is waiting for me. Missus, where are you? And that's our story for this evening. I hope you enjoyed An Artist's Story by Anton Chekhov. Thank you for listening. I'm Jennifer March, and this is not your mother's story time.